like to welcome everybody out and just comment on the attendance tonight. I appreciate, especially this time of year, I know everything gets busy with start of summer, and appreciate everyone's schedule to be able to take time. And I know we were in Moab earlier today and seen how busy it is, so I know Daryl, from a law enforcement standpoint, appreciate your efforts, so and everyone. Start off with approval of the agenda and the minutes. Everyone have a chance to take a look at them?
Can I approve half of it? Because I wasn't here last time, so I don't know if the minutes. Okay, I can approve the agenda.
Okay. Got a motion to approve the agenda. Do we have a second?
Sure.
Okay, seconded by Daryl Meekum. All in favor?
Aye.
How about the minutes, though?
How about the minutes? Anyone had to take a look? I did have a chance to take a look at the minutes, and they did look good, but I'll entertain people to make a motion.
I'll move to accept the minutes.
Okay, motion by Todd. Seconded by Tricia. Good job. All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? I'll give an update on the Wildlife Board. I know we had several discussions from our RAC, and I'll do my best to fill you in on how those discussions went. And if I don't do adequate in filling that in, please just ask questions, and Chris and I will do our best. We can go to Dr. King. So to start off, there was some discussion on the conservation and sportsman permit rule, and Dr. King asked about the wording in the amendment that we had a lot of discussion here about to the conservation and sportsman permit rule. Justin Shannon had explored the rule beforehand, and he learned that the rule, the amendment that we were approving, referenced the rule, and in the rule the specific name was the Western Conservation Permit. So the division felt that there wasn't any need, that it was already, that language was already there that we were seeking. So the board approved the amendment as proposed. Several of the RACs had made the motion to leave the beaver and the Vernon deer buck harvest levels at the 2014 levels. One of the things that the division's been doing is going to all the RACs, taking those comments and making a motion beforehand of an amended motion of what the public wanted. So that was the division's motion from hearing all of the RACs, was to leave the beaver and the Vernon unit at the 2014 levels. There was a lot of discussion from the board on the regarding the Manti and the LaSalle, that we had a lot of discussion here. The question was asked whether the DWR's recommendation will affect the growth of the mule deer on those units. The answer given by the division is no. Fawns and does drive the population. They said, however, it does affect the quality of the deer on the deer hunt. In regards to the LaSalle's, it was stated the DWR cut permits 2 years ago, and they want to wait another year before they considered additional cuts. On the Manti, the board cut permits when they went to the 30 units. Three of the five RACs had voted to decrease the buck permits on the Manti. And so with that, there was a lot of discussion by the Wildlife Board, and the division's recommendation was to increase those permits by 500, with with after discussion, much discussion from the Wildlife Board, many questions. The motion was made to only increase those permits by 150, and that motion passed unanimously.
So now, so three out of the five RACs voted to keep it the same or to decrease it?
Yeah, three of the five RACs had various numbers, but it was all.
And one of those was us that said to leave it the same as.
The Vernon was only, the northern region was 100.
To increase it 100 from last year?
Yeah. And I don't know if you remember what the other one was.
But I don't. None of the RACs voted to decrease it from the 2014 levels, either to keep it the same or to not increase it as much as 500.
Right. Okay. The northern region would have only been an increase of 100 from the 2014 levels. And so with that, there was much discussion, and so they voted to only have an increase of 150 after all the RACs. So.
All right.
There was a lot of discussion regarding the Henry Mountain Bison. The committee met in March, and there wasn't any concerns brought up by the committee that weren't resolved at that time. But there was a lot of the same permittees that come to the board meeting, and in the southern region, they'd made a motion to increase. Which was kind of weird, but they made the motion to increase any choice permits by 10. And there was a lot of discussion that a lot of those permittees were at the Wildlife Board, and it was very well attended Wildlife Board.
And that was because of the drought.
Yeah.
And they foresaw the drought would continue to happen.
Okay. There was a lot of discussion that they felt that if the drought continued, that they felt like they should give more permits. The Wildlife Board felt like that this wasn't the meeting to address drought, that there's a Wildlife Board meeting already in place in August, and that if there was a drought and there was the need, that they would be able to, they have the flights in July for the bison, they'd be able to know the exact numbers, know what drought conditions are, and be able to make those additional permits at that time. And so that's what the Wildlife Board decided to do, is wait on those. The remaining recommendation, including the bison numbers, passed unanimous. There was an action log item to look at splitting up the Manti into two units, the north and the south.
For deer.
They want to know if the data would support a split, how would splitting them affect permit numbers, how does the buck-to-doe ratio differ between the south and north, and so this will come through a process. The division will have time to explore that and come back through the RAC process and explain that. So there was a lot of discussion in the Wildlife Board of, some of our, what we'd heard from the public is maybe the north end's doing better than the south end, and the Wildlife Board asked them to explore that.
And we're on schedule to redo the unit management plan for the Manti this year, and so in that plan process we'll have open houses and get the public's input, but we'll explore that idea of splitting it up.
Similar to, I mean, obviously on a bigger scale, but similar to what they're doing in the Book Cliffs, splitting that north and south?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. All right.
I did, and maybe you want to address this better, but I did ask... we did have much discussion on the conservation permit and the allocation of dollars, and the division is going to bring an item to one of the meetings. They didn't say which one, but they will come as an item and bring that down as far as the conservation permit and those dollars.
Hopefully, maybe the next RAC, and I think it's in August, is that right? So our next RAC meeting, we'll have a presentation to give to you about how that money breaks down and how we audit the sportsman groups. Let me just make one clarification. So the sportsman groups We keep 40% as internal conservation permit money. We give them 70%. We keep 30. We give them 70. 10% is administrative use, and the 60% is for projects. So they get 60% for projects. What ends up happening is they end up writing us a check for that entire 60%. So we get that entire 60% back, and that's where we match it with nonprofit dollars and state dollars and BLM dollars, and we create these watershed restoration projects. And so, and we are able to, you know, we can tell you where all those dollars have been spent, on which year, on which project. So that's 90% of the dollars there. The other 10%, and that was the big discussion item last time too, is where that 10% goes. As an agency, we don't necessarily need to see where that 10% goes. That's administrative costs, and there is no audit for that, as far as I understand it. We do check the sportsman group's bank accounts, and it's a pretty strict audit, is what I'm told. And hopefully we can explain that process more in August for you.
All right. Any questions? Regional?
That's it?
Were you waiting?
I'm waiting for Chris or Blair or Trish to make comments on that.
Well, I guess I kind of keep going back to, which is I need to do more research on this, is that, you know, I want to make sure that the division is, those tags are going to a viable nonprofit, 501c3. And in my, I guess, knowledge of a 501c3, which maybe like Sue can help me out about, is that you have to be able to show, you should always have your financials, you know, public. And I just am saying I can't find those on a couple of those conservation organizations. So to me, that means they're not falling into a viable 501c3. That's where my, does that make sense?
Yeah, and since that meeting, I've looked at RMEF's information you find on their website, and it's pretty impressive. They have report, and it details, you know, postage and rent.
Absolutely.
And, you know, these
and
things.
That's how
whether I still don't know if it's going to be in the level of detail that maybe Blair wants, you know, specific receipts and who's you know, invoices to this person or this company.
But RMEF doesn't have anything to do with the Conservation Expo, a hunting expo in February.
Right.
It's Mule Deer Foundation and SFW.
And
those financials
are not. But they have conservation permit dollars
there
that they spend. So it's
well,
it's, and
that's true. Right. But we're talking about, in the context of that discussion, last RAC, it was the Hunting Expo and those two organizations. And that's what Trish is saying, is those financials are not current.
The Mule Deer Foundation, their last financials are 2008 that I could find. And SFW, I cannot find any financials anywhere. And their website, the last time I went, prior they had a tab that said financials, but it wouldn't pull up. Now those tabs are just gone. They removed. So at least there's, I mean, maybe it's in process.
There's action on that anyway, then.
You see, where I'm just more concerned that are they falling into being a viable 501c3? And do you know that, Sue, about do you have to show?
I sit on the board of many 501c3s, and I work for one. I would think the integrity would be that would be available in an annual report, not down to the level of receipts. But it's not. Some 501c3s where I sit on their board, they're very young and we don't even do annual reports yet.
Okay.
I mean, that would be an IRS question. And the IRS regulates 501c3s.
And I've looked at the IRS and it's not extremely detailed as to, it just says there should be transparency. It doesn't, it's not specific.
Yeah,
RMEF, I use them as actually a good example because they produce these annual reports not only as a national national organization, but they do it statewide too. So you can look at the state of Utah and look exactly, which is super smart for them because, you know, your donors know exactly where their dollars are going, right? But that's where my, does that make sense? I'm concerned about is that we're giving those tags to viable 501c3s. But yeah, that's
Chris.
It.
Within a week of our last meeting, KSL News did a report that concerns Wortsmouth for Fish and Wildlife, and that they were paying huge amounts to lobbyists for the state legislature. Is this 10% going to pay lobbyists? Because if it is, I have a huge problem with that. It was over $500,000 they paid in salary to a gentleman that's part of his job. Well, if that's part of our 10% that they're getting for administrative fees, I do have a big problem with that.
I can't speak to where that 10%
is going.
Yeah,
and I know you can't.
But the was it $500,000 that you said that went to the lobbyist?
That went to
Big Game Forever, and that was legislatively mandated and part of the legislative budget.
So
the state paid that to this group.
Okay, well,
for wolves.
Okay, I'm concerned that the 10% we're using is going to lobby for special interests for those conservation groups, or for those special interest groups. That, you know, I just, are they going and lobbying for things they want with money that comes from these conservation tax? So.
And there is a difference between a 501c3 and another type of nonprofit, which is like 501 something, and it deals on how much you can spend on lobbying.
Mm-hmm.
Only be
right.
A certain percentage. So they need to.
The 501c4, and we can spend 100%
right.
Of our
money. So they need to be. Their board needs to be careful that they're following the IRS regulations, they can be turned into the IRS.
And we don't want to become the IRS. I mean, that's not our job.
Yeah, we don't want to be.
No.
It's their board. It's the board is that's their responsibility.
So hopefully in this meeting in August we can get some much needed clarification on all that. And I know Chris talked to him, and I was up there Thursday, and I expressed that concern, and hopefully we'll get that. So.
All right. We have been very, very busy, and we're getting to the busiest part of the year. Maybe every part of the year is busy, but let's see. We are in the process of selecting new RAC positions for this region. We have two openings. Wayne is leaving us after tonight. It's his last RAC meeting, and then we have a position open from Seth Allred. His first term is over, so we've done some interviews, and hopefully in the next week or two or three, we'll let those candidates know if they've been chosen or not. But we're looking for a non-consumptive rep and an at-large, public at-large rep. Let's see, some fun things. Social media, look in the next few weeks. We're going to have a Facebook page just for the southeastern part of the state for the Division of Wildlife. So you can like that Facebook page and you can see what we're doing, and you can be involved in some of the events that we have. It'll be more specific to our region. And then, this might be a little premature to announce, but kind of something fun. We're actually in negotiations with a TV company, a TV producing company, that wants to come to Utah and produce a reality TV show based on the Division of Wildlife. And certainly we have some characters that we can provide them to make some entertaining TV. And some exciting cases and work, and it'll involve law enforcement, but also other wildlife work as well. And then if you see 30 state vehicles on May 28th here in Green River, it's because we're having a regional meeting. Our aquatic section has been very busy. We just got done gill netting today at Schofield. We gill netted last week at Huntington. Today at Schofield, I was there this morning. There was a lot of chubs that we got in the nets. There was some big trout as well. But the chubs were comparable to the number we got last year, or last fall and last spring. But from what I understand, they were bigger chubs, and there wasn't very many small chubs, which means that hopefully that is an indicator that management there is working, and that the smaller trout are being eaten by the larger fish that we want in the river or in the lake. At Huntington, there were some big wipers that were caught in the gill nets, big ones. I think
3 to 5 pounders. So some big fish there. And there's an age class that they know that exists in the lake that they haven't been able to get in the gillnets. So there's some big wipers at Huntington to be caught. Free fishing day is on June 6th. And then we have community fisheries. We have three in Carbon County, Giotti Pond, the one at the Carbon Fairgrounds, and the new one in Wellington called the Knight Ideal Pond. Right now those are stocked and fishable. With the water shortages, we're not sure how that's going to affect these community ponds. We know that Giotti, we have to turn off the water and only bring in fresh, clean water as it gets really low. So at the other ponds, we might be turning off water mid-season and putting in an emergency notice for people to come and fish before all the fish die. But we'll see how the summer shakes out and how much water we have. But we're sensitive to the drought and the water issues, and if we need to, we can sacrifice some community fisheries midway through the season. We have a bighorn sheep watch on June 13th at Sunnyside. That's always a great event. You usually see a bunch of sheep. We've also been working with archery events at the SFW banquet back in April, working with Boy Scouts and hosting archery events. And then we have a program, hopefully you're aware of, the walk-in access program, where you can sign up to hunt and fish on private lands and the landowner gets compensated. We had a few additional signups this last month. One in particular, Senator Hinken's father, who lives in
Orangeville.
He signed up his property to fish, so that should be coming online any week now.
Cool.
And Habitat's been busy too. There's a Ford Bridge project with a BLM happening north of Price, and then we teamed up with MDF and the local horseman group in Emory and Carbon County, and some dedicated hunters, and planted over 5,000 shrubs at our Gordon Creek WMA last Saturday. And then at Beef Basin, we teamed up with SFW, and we planted 1,700 shrubs in Beef Basin. Law enforcement's been busy too. There's a big emphasis at Lake Powell. I forgot to mention in the aquatics slide that we are hiring a new biologist, an aquatic invasive species, so a quagga mussel biologist, to specifically cover the Lake Powell area. He'll be a full-time employee, work year-round, but to protect the rest of the state from the infestation that you see at Lake Powell. We're having a checkpoint there this week in Hanksville this weekend to check boats that are coming off. So we have full-time staff on the ramps at Bullfrog. All day long checking boats coming off and making sure they're clean and they get decontaminated and they understand the rules and regulations. And then periodically throughout the summer, as in this weekend, we'll have law enforcement checkpoints stationed at various parts of the state checking boats and having a mandatory check station where they pull off and make sure they're in compliance, they've drained properly and decontaminated. So what else? We're still wrapping up some investigations from the trapping season, and the ice is off the reservoirs, and people are out fishing, and our officers are busy. And the wildlife section, we've been busy working with the habitat section. The wildlife section have been teaming up together and going out on these winter range rides or patrols and doing vegetation transects on these winter ranges. The idea behind that is to see what the condition of the range is, how much use the range got, and document any kind of winter kills or shrub utilization that they measure. You can see the other things we've got. The turkey hunt is still going on through the end of May. Our sensitive species biologist, Tony Wright, will be busy doing Abert squirrel surveys on the Abajos and the LaSalles and continuing his burrowing owl research as well. And then we've teamed up with a few different groups this last month, the Moab group, the Moab bird group, and we did bird surveys at Desert Lake and down at the Matheson Preserve this last few weeks. And we're still trying to plan, figure out what we're going to do with our Gunnison sage-grouse watches, both sage-grouse watches, but specifically the Gunnison sage-grouse watch. We're still trying to figure out whether, as a federally protected species, whether we can have a public viewing or not. So those decisions will hopefully be made in the next few months. And with that, I'll entertain any questions.
Question on Free Fishing Day. Is that specific to that Wellington, or is that a statewide?
That's a good question.
It is statewide.
Statewide.
We have a special event.
Oh, okay. That's what I figured it was statewide. But okay.
Okay.
Any word on a conservation officer for us?
Yeah, for Moab. Us is Moab?
Yeah.
Okay, so we have officers that have. There's a long process by the time you announce the position until they come to a region.
Okay.
They have to go through post, and they have to go through division training. And then, anyways, what I hear is by this late fall, early winter, if all the applicants pan out, there'll be enough applicants or candidates or officers through the training to have to place one in Moab.
Okay.
So hopefully by the end of the year.
Okay.
That's high on our...
So
it's our,
free
it's,
for all until the end.
Well, we have officers. You know, we have one in Blanding and one in Monticello,
right,
and yeah,
okay.
And they will continue to cover this area.
Okay.
And TJ's in Price, so he's not too
right.
far away.
Right.
He's familiar.
Right.
So, is that it? Okay. Before we go to the rest of our meeting, I just wanted to honor Wayne. I have only been here, you know, as a regular RAC attendee for about 2 years, but I've been very impressed with you, Wayne. You've been amazing. 8 years serving on the RAC, right? I'm just impressed with your attendance. You've been here, I think, every single time that I've been here. I mean, you might have missed one or two throughout the 8 years, but you're here almost every single time. And you come well prepared. When you come with questions, when you do have an opinion, I think it's always well thought and articulate. And even if people don't agree with you, I think people listen and think about what you're saying and give it some thought. And even in meetings that you've got to know that isn't going to go your way, predator management type meetings that you might be the only one or two lone votes, you still come and represent the constituents, the people that you represent, your constituency. And so I think that's very commendable, and I respect that a ton. So we have a gift for you.
I got you a water bottle.
We usually give Brunson prints to RAC members,
no.
But I didn't think that a big picture of an elk or even worse, a mountain goat would be appropriate for Wayne. So there's a photographer in Moab, John Fuller. He actually had an exhibit last month at the Weser Town Museum. There you go.
Yeah.
This is one of his prints of Dead Horse Point, and I thought you'd
nice.
Like this better than a Brunson print. We appreciate all that you did for our RAC. I think, Kevin, you want to say something too?
Yeah.
And anyone else, if anyone else wants to chime in, go for it.
I served on the time with Wayne, most of his time. And one of the things I appreciate most is Wayne is even on, when we're doing permit numbers or stuff, I appreciated that maybe, it's not something that was 100% of your passion, but you still thoroughly read that, and you would catch grammar errors and different things that nobody
right.
else saw, and I or very important things, and I really appreciated that, and I was always glad that I knew you were reading the packet. I felt good.
He's had somebody in for
had it in Wayne's hand, so thanks, Wayne.
Speech.
Well, thank you. I just was reading Will Rogers, and he gave a great speech. He says, "Never pass up an opportunity to shut up."
Thanks.
Wayne, having said that, you can point the microphone.
Thank you, Wayne. Your service is appreciated.
turn? Okay.
Yep.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tonight I'll be presenting 15-2016 migratory game bird hunt recommendations. Before I get into the actual recommendations, I want to just go through and give a few updates that are happening in the migratory bird program. One of those is our recommendation process. Currently, we've been operating on a pretty short time frame. We meet as a flyway in July of each year and put forward proposals to the Fish and Wildlife Service for our hunt recommendations. Those are typically accepted the first part of August. We then go through and do a state selection process for our season dates, and those are published in the Federal Register, usually sometime in September. And then our hunts proceed usually in about the middle of September. It's a pretty tight time crunch, and so we've been working with them for several years to try to extend our window and provide more opportunity for us to get those done in a timely manner and not be pushed right up against when our hunts are starting. So for the 2016 recommendations, those will begin this fall. We'll meet in September as the flyways, have those approved in October, and then our state selection process will be moved up to December. So this coming December, we'll be doing our 2016-17 recommendations. So we'll have almost 9 months before the hunt season begins, so we'll have time to do our guidebooks and all that stuff. So that's what we're looking forward to this year. Right now we'll be doing our 2015-16 recommendations. And so there is the potential for those to change when we meet as a flyway in July. If they do, we'll just go with whatever is the maximum allowed by the Fish and Wildlife Service for season length and harvest. And then this December, we'll proceed with our 2016-17 recommendations. I also wanted to talk a little bit about our waterfowl hunt numbers and waterfowl populations across North America. We've been tracking waterfowl hunters here in Utah since about the mid-40s, and for the most part, they've trended really well with our waterfowl populations. As populations have gone down, we tend to see fewer hunters, and as the number of birds go up, we tend to see more hunters. That's really held true up until about year 2000 or so, and we saw quite a dramatic decrease in the number of people hunting here in Utah. They really haven't rebounded since. However, during that time, we've seen almost exponential growth in our duck populations. We've had fantastic water years across the prairies and seen the number of ducks really skyrocket in the last 10 years. We don't really know why the number of hunters have remained lower, but we are working to try to increase our recruitment and retention efforts across the state. We've provided a variety of hunter workshops in last year to try to get people educated and provide more skills so they can participate in waterfowl hunting. We've also worked on providing more access across the state for people to participate, as well as beefing up our online resources and other resources to try to provide more maps and online tutorials and things like that so people will be aware of when they can actually go and hunt waterfowl. Really, right now is probably the best time we've ever had in the state to hunt waterfowl. We've got the more ducks than we've ever had in recorded history, and so there's a great resource out there for everyone to go out and enjoy. Last update is I'm on a duck stamp increase. This is the federal duck stamp, and this increase will go into effect for this upcoming waterfowl season. This is a program that was implemented quite a few years ago, and 98% of every dollar that's spent on duck stamps goes directly toward habitat acquisition and conservation easements across North America. To date, this program's raised $800 million, and we've conserved about 6 million acres of waterfowl habitat. So it's really a successful program, but it has been lacking in recent years because the buying power of the duck stamp has decreased. In 1991, it was estimated that you could restore or purchase an acre of waterfowl habitat for about $306. And today, it's probably close to about $1,100 per acre. And so for that reason, Congress authorized the increase of the duck stamp this last fall to go from $15 to $25. And so that'll go into effect for July 1, so anybody purchasing a duck stamp for this fall or just have a duck stamp, we'll see that increase beginning in July. Now moving into our population data for waterfowl, as I mentioned earlier, we've seen great increases in the number of ducks across North America for the last 10 or 15 years. Last year was the highest population count we've had on record for ducks, so ducks are doing great in North America. For Canada geese, we look primarily at our Rocky Mountain population of Canada geese. They've been on the increase for a number of years now and continue to be steady and a really healthy population here in our region. Tundra swans as well, they've been increasing since the 60s. Similar population growth to geese, they continue to generally increase. And so we really don't have any concerns either for our tundra swan populations. So getting into our recommendations, our hunt structures are based primarily on the population of mallards in western part of North America. If we have a really strong population, we'll have a liberal season, and given the number of ducks that we have right now, we would expect to have another liberal season this year. It should be a 107-day season with a bag of seven. We also have pintail, canvasback, and scop. These are separate from this liberal package. They're three species that have species-specific harvest strategies, which implies that they have specific season lengths and bag limits specific for them. And we would expect to see this year from the Fish and Wildlife Service will allow us to have about what we had last year. None of these populations have seen any dramatic decreases or really increases, so they should be similar to the bags and season lengths we had last year. So for our waterfowl season dates, the general hunt will begin on October 3rd and run until the 16th of January. And if we do have that 86-day scop season, that'll also begin on October 3rd and run until December 27th. All their bag limits for ducks, coots, snipes, and the falconry bag limits will be the same though as last year. And those three species, if they do change from what we had in previous years, we'll just go whatever the maximum allowed is by the Fish and Wildlife Service. So for our dark goose hunt zones and season dates, none of these have changed from the previous year. We'll have these three zones as well as similar dates from what we've had in the past. For our light goose zones, we are adjusting the season dates in the urban zone and the rest of the state area. We primarily focus our season dates for light geese on when they're in the state. We see a few that will move through in the fall, usually around the November time period. But the majority of these are coming through the state later in the spring to late winter. And so we're adjusting these a little bit to try to provide some opportunity for people who want to hunt some of the light geese that begin moving back through the state. The end of January, first part of February. But other than that, these season dates will be fairly similar to what they were last year in the same bag and possession limits.
Question.
Yeah?
So how many hunters actually reach that 20-day
season? I've never talked to anybody who's ever shot that many snow geese here in Utah. It's fairly liberal bag limit just to provide some harvest opportunity because light geese have been going gangbusters the last several years. There are some concerns that they are eating themselves out of house and home up in the northern tundra. And so we've tried to liberalize our season just to provide additional harvest. But here in Utah, we're just such a small player for light geese that, you know, a couple light geese in a day is usually pretty good. So. Most of the birds that we have will winter in California, and so most of them will come from the northern part of North America, and they'll come down through usually the Box Elder County, see some, and Millard County as well. The rest of the state really doesn't see a whole lot. When they come back north, quite a few will stage on Gunnison, Bend Reservoir, and Delta, and they'll be there for a couple weeks, and then they'll stop over in Box Elder County and then keep moving north. So it's really a limited hunt and provides limited opportunity, but for the guys that do it, they do enjoy it. So for our swan season, it'll be the same as it has been in years past as well. The same area just around the Great Salt Lake and the same number of permits. For Youth Day, that will occur on September 17th or 19th, which is 2 weeks before the general waterfowl season. And then we'll keep our shooting time standard as we did last year. Just have a half hour before sunrise to official sunset, and that'll be for every day of the season. And the only other change we're making with migratory game birds, this is one that we use including our upland selection, but we did need to make one change this year for band-tailed pigeons. We've been working with the service for several years now to develop a harvest strategy for band-tailed pigeons. And we've finalized that, and we have had some concerns just because we don't have great population data on band-tailed pigeons. We primarily use our breeding bird survey data, which does provide a decent trend, and we haven't seen any large decreases in the population for 20 years. But we did want to be a little more conservative in our season dates. We've reduced that from 30 to 14 days just to provide a little bit of cushion in there until we can get some better data for band-tailed pigeons. And lastly, just a few changes we're making to the waterfowl rule this year. We're changing or updating the name of common snipe to Wilson snipe, which is the currently correct name for that bird. We're also clarifying the rest areas and non-shooting areas in our rule. Probably the most Controversially, one of these was the Antelope Island Causeway that we changed several years ago. We just needed to better define that in our rules. We went through and did that for the causeway, as well as for the Salt Lake City Airport and the Boat Harbor and the Great Salt Lake. And we also went through and just better clarified our rest areas and some of our waterfowl management areas. And then the last change is just to update a blind regulation that we have on Farrington Bay waterfowl management area, and just changing a few of the rules that are allowed for one of the units there. And that is our migratory bird regular conditions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the RAC? Questions from Walt?
He is special.
We start here in November. December. Go till June.
See what we can do. Yeah.
Questions from the audience?
Just you and no one here.
Comments from the audience? Okay. Comments from the back? Entertain a motion.
Move to accept as presented.
Motion by Todd Huntington to...
I'll second.
Okay. To accept the waterfowl recommendations and seconded by Keith Brady. Any questions? All in favor? Any opposed? Are you abstention or are you in favor?
No, I was... So does this include the changes?
I believe that's the whole presentation, which is the changes in code, is that correct?
Yep. Okay. Yeah, so it'd be everything as presented.
Yes.
Okay, good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Scott McFarland. I'm the Private Lands Public Wildlife Coordinator. And this evening, or late afternoon, whichever it is, I will be presenting changes to our urban deer control rule, R657-65. Currently, we have an urban deer control rule that was established as a pilot program in August of 2013 with Bountiful and Highland Cities. And our purpose in establishing that rule was we wanted to evaluate a two-year pilot program that enabled each city to design and administer a control plan for the lethal and or non-lethal removal of their resident deer damaging private property or threatening public safety. And currently this rule will sunset August 31st of 2015. That's when the 2 years is up. Why did we have this pilot program? We wanted to test the logistical and economic feasibility of controlling urban deer populations on a large-scale basis. This is something we've never really done in the state. We've had an increasing urban deer population in a lot of cities throughout the state. We also wanted to determine the effectiveness and the cost of the various deer control techniques in an urban setting. So with Highland City, Highland City and Bountiful had two pretty much opposite methods that they chose to address their urban deer problems. Highland City chose a plan to use certified volunteer archers to lethally remove deer from their properties in their city. The plan was completely city run, and it was designed and directed by the city. And the results of that, in 2013, they removed 72 deer using the certified volunteer archers. They logged in 322 hours, volunteer hours on that, and they donated about 5,500 pounds of meat. They provided a lot of meals for meaty families and people. So, in 2014, they removed 42 deer. They logged in 184 volunteer hours, and what this came out to be is about 4.5 hours per deer that was removed. So, In contrast, yes?
Is the change in numbers harvested because urban deer herd was decreasing? Or?
If you ask the Highland City people, they said because it was due to a drop in the deer numbers in the areas where they were harvesting those. So, yeah. Bountiful City, as in a contrast, they chose a non-lethal trap and remove program in cooperation with the division. The city was responsible for providing employees for the project, and they provided two employees. It was at our disposal, basically, to help with it throughout the whole trapping period. They were also responsible for signing up residents and identifying the trap locations within their city. And they're also responsible for enforcing a new feeding ordinance. The division was responsible for choosing the appropriate trap method, organizing volunteer efforts, checking traps and processing the deer and transporting the deer to an approved release site. The objectives of this were we wanted to determine the effectiveness and cost of translocation of deer from the city. It's something we hadn't done before. We wanted to look at public perception pre and post removal and assess the changes in deer vehicle collisions as a measure of effectiveness. So the results of that, and this is still a project that's underway, but in 2014 we just barely got started. This took quite an effort to get on the ground and get started. And we only had a couple of weeks to do this in 2014, but 36 deer were relocated in that year, in that winter. 2014 and 15, we were kind of geared up for it. It was a difficult trapping year. There was no snow to trap deer. You need them to be hungry. But we still did pretty good. We relocated 211 deer from Bountiful City. And it took about 10 to 15 volunteers a day. That's how many showed up. That's not how many was necessary, but there's a lot of people that really enjoyed doing this. But 10 to 15 volunteers a day plus two DWR personnel. It took about 3 hours a day to process the deer and averaged about six deer per trap day. And as a comparison, it took about 3.8 hours of deer, not including the transportation. That's just to process them. They went from, they did it either 2 to 3 days a week, and they started December 1st and went until about the 1st of March. So,
it's a lot of work.
Yeah, it was a lot of work. So some of the preliminary results, as I said, this is still an ongoing project with him, but with Bountiful. And both methods were effective in removing deer from within city limits. The non-lethal methods were definitely more costly, time and labor intensive. Survival estimates with non-lethal removal have yet to be determined. All the adult deer in the Bountiful project were radio collared, and we're looking at survival on those. We still have one more year left to complete the project. And non-lethal is... removal is not always an option in some areas. Found that out.
So. Scott, where did you take them? Where did they get
the Bountiful deer went to two different locations. A year ago, we went and through the statewide deer management plan, identified translocation sites that were approved through the public process. And what we looked at with all those sites, we chose two sites. One was in northern Box Elder County, and the other one was out in Big Wash, just south of Mighton in Duchesne County. I think it's Duchesne County. And those are the two sites that these deer went to. We looked at several things. We wanted to have places that historically had good numbers of deer that were, for whatever reason, didn't have any deer or had low numbers of deer. We wanted to make sure they weren't impacting agriculture. There's several criteria that we looked at when we did that. So, and places that had had habitat projects also. So with this, the purpose of this urban control deer rule, and this is the purpose before and it is now, is to enable a city to design and administer a control plan for the lethal or non-lethal removal of year-round resident deer damaging private property or threatening public safety within the city. So the changes to the rule that we're proposing, first change, we want to make this available to all the cities statewide with population greater than 1,000. We want to emphasizing targeting resident year-round deer. We want to require an annual report of lethal removal activities, and the cities must petition the division to include any capture and relocation plans or non-lethal removal. And the division has the sole discretion to authorize or prohibit such activities as part of the plan. So we've got some safeguards, and some of this is a little redundant on the changes, but the division, this is probably the main role that we will have in these plans, is that we will specify the seasonal time period when the deer may be removed, the total number of deer that may be removed annually, and the number of deer by gender that may be removed. And we're going to require annual reports on all non-lethal removal, and the capture and live removal has to be agreed on and authorized by the division. The division and the city can terminate the plan, or the city can terminate the plan within 7 days of written advance notice. And the city has to renew authorizations every 3 years and must go through the public review process to make sure that it's something that's acceptable to the public. So, and the process that a city has to go through on this is basically they obtain a certificate of registration, and a certificate of registration, or a COR, is just a document that the division would issue them that would allow them to design a plan and design and implement a plan. So the city would design the plan with public input following the guidelines that are specified in the certificate of registration and the rule. And the city would present a plan for public comment. The city implements the plan. They provide annual reports to the division, and they have to renew it every 3 years if they choose to using the public review process. So with that, thank you.
Any questions from the RAC?
Yeah, I have a couple here if I could. Are there very many cities that have this problem with resident deer other than Highland and Bountiful? Others, are they mostly up along the Wasatch Front, or are they scattered throughout the state?
Yes. They're scattered. Okay. It's actually a statewide problem. Probably some of the squeakiest wheels are along the Wasatch Front, but right now there's probably between 6 and 8 cities apiece in the northern and central regions along the Wasatch Front. I think even Monticello would probably be looking at something like this. Torrey, there's quite a widespread urban deer problem, so yeah.
And then with this, it sounds like they have to be a resident deer, meaning they don't, it's not just because they're in there for winter range, it's year-round that they're in that urban area.
That's true. And that's why the division wants to specify the time, the timing of removal, whether it be lethal or non-lethal removal, is going to kind of dictate whether it's a resident or a migratory or a transient deer. That's why we want to have those sideboards put on there.
And then just one last question. Any particular size, is that a determining factor, the size of the resident deer herd within a particular urban area? I mean, 50, 100, 20, I don't know.
No, it's not going to be on size. In order to obtain a certificate of registration, they have to meet several criteria. They just have to show that there's property damage being done, or it's a public health or safety risk. And so the size has nothing to do with it. It just has to be documented as a problem.
Okay. So that's all the questions I have. Thanks.
Even though I have resident deer herds, probably at least two, one on the west side of the city, they're small, so I don't know that they're a problem yet, but they do draw cougar in, so they lose quite a few cats and dogs.
It's just leaving alone. It's the only habitat we have for. I kind of like having them there.
I used to see the tracks in my yard. Yeah. Oh, jeez.
Therefore, the public process. You know, if the city, if the residents don't want this type of program, then we would be able to hopefully vote that out. So.
Were there any issues whatsoever with the lethal removal? I mean, I'm an archer, and you know, they don't always just fall right down. You know what I mean? Were there any issues like that? I mean, I'm just interested.
On that front, no. The issues came. The way Highland City did this was they trained certified archers, and they had such a rigorous training, and they had to be like really good marksmen, and they did this basically without anybody knowing it. They would go in after dark or before before daylight, and there were some complaints on it, but they didn't even know it was after the process was already done, and they found out that it was happening, and they complained about it, but nobody really knew that it happened. All the arrows had to be marked with the archer's name. I mean, it was a very stringent process they went through. So, but no, there wasn't. So.
Since we're a small group, let me ask.
Sure.
With the number of deer taken, the amount of meat donated, the amount of is 17 pounds per deer, and I was wondering if that was a runoff of deer confined, or what was there?
I'd have to get. I'm not really good with math in my head, but it seems like it was. It was like 70 pounds of deer, I think, per deer. Don't look at both years. There was only the amount was only calculated for the first year, so.
It's
about 70 pounds of deer.
Okay. Questions from the audience?
Really? No questions.
Comments from the audience? All right. Comments from the rack.
I have a question. With this being a sunset, after it's done, then are there going to be an evaluation period and then maybe re-implement, or is it just going to kind of go away?
Well,
because you mentioned this was just a trial period, basically.
Yeah, basically the rule is a two-year trial program, and it sunsets August 31st of this year. So what we're changing the rule so that it no longer has a sunset date, it will become a rule that has no ending date. It'll be reviewed at least every 5 years, but that's one of the changes to the rule, is that we're going to make it available to all cities, and it'll be perpetual until we repeal the rule. So, okay.
Good question.
Don't be shy, people.
Entertain a motion.
I can't do them all. Move to accept as presented.
Okay. Motion by Todd Huntington to approve the urban deer control as presented by DWR. Seconded by...
I'll second it.
Gerald. Take our pick. Chris Meekles. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Unanimous. All right. Since Darris isn't here, we'll move on to our next election of the RAC chairman. So I'll leave this up.
Okay. So I understand that. What does the rule say? We have the ability right now to elect a new RAC chair, or we can have Kevin serve another 2 years. I believe. Is that right? 2 years.
So you serve as a chair for 2 years with an option to serve two more years. The RAC chairman, as Kevin does so well each week, runs the meeting. But another huge responsibility is to go to the board meeting and represent the RAC at the board meeting, which is a pretty big commitment. And I think Kevin's been there most board meetings. Might have been one or two in the last 2 years he hasn't been able to attend, but he's been able to attend most of them. So we have some discussion. If anyone wants to have that experience of being the representative of the board and being the chairman of this RAC, we can certainly entertain some motions to nominate somebody, or we could have a motion to re-elect Kevin, and he can continue doing it if he agrees to do so.
Kevin, do you want to do it again?
I'll put it this way. I'll do it again, but if somebody would like that opportunity, I will gladly give it.
Kevin.
My other question is, how much longer does Darius have? Why did I think, is he still not a while? I didn't think about
years.
That.
Two more years.
Okay.
Two more years.
And your advice?
Anybody have any interest in doing it?
Well, I think Kevin.
Second.
Yeah. I was going to go after you again, Todd. No, I'm just kidding.
Don't do that.
Okay. And right now, our vice chair, I think, is Todd.
Yeah.
And he's around the meeting a time or two. We can have a motion to continue him being our vice chair, or
somebody else.
Or somebody else. It's your rack.
Yeah, so I'll just make the comment. Sometimes during fire season, it's a little bit difficult for me to go, and I know Todd's had to fill in for me, but I have a pretty good job in that I can usually attend those meetings unless I'm gone on fire. So.
Well, I think you've done a great job, Kevin.
Thanks, Sue.
Keep the course.
I think him and Todd work well together.
There you go.
Good ones. Why rock the boat?
Yeah.
Right. And in 2 years, it can be one of you, too, so you might not miss that opportunity
we'll
yet.
We'll both be done in 2 years.
So. Yeah. There'll be a lot of us leave in 2 years.
It's true.
Okay.
So do I hear a motion?
Yeah, I make the motion. Let Todd hang out.
Okay. So who did you have the first motion as well? So there's Okay, so there's a motion by Daryl Meacham to have Kevin be our chairman and Todd Huntington be our co-chairman, or vice chairman. Is there a second?
Second that.
Carl, second. Okay, all in favor, aye?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay.
Too bad you're railroading in. Thank you. All right.